Chapter 6. God or Atoms. What then is the nature of God? Is it flesh? God forbid. Land? God forbid. Fame? God forbid. It is intelligence, knowledge, right reason. In these then, and nowhere else, seek the true nature of the good. Epictetus, Discourses, Book 2, Chapter 8. I do have a major disagreement with my friend Epictetus, and yet the fact that we can have such diverging opinions on a fundamental matter and still see eye to eye about how to live our lives is one of the most precious features of Stoicism. It makes room for both religious believers and unbelievers, united by their common understanding of ethics regardless of their diverging metaphysics. When I asked Epictetus about his view of God, he replied, "Who is it that has fitted the sword to the scabbard and the scabbard to the sword? Is there no one? Surely the very structure of such finished products leads us commonly to infer that they must be the work of some craftsman and are not constructed at random. Are we to say, then, that each of these products points to the craftsman, but that things visible and vision and light do not? Do not male and female and the desire of union and the power to use the organs adapted for it, do not these point to the craftsman?" This is a remarkable early example, since it was written in the 2nd century CE, of what is known as the argument from design to support the existence of God. A variation of it was later used by prominent Christian theologians, such as Thomas Aquinas, and it is perhaps best known in the formulation of the 19th century natural theologian William Paley, who articulated it just a few decades before Darwin wrote On the Origin of Species. In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer I had before given, that for anything I knew the watch might have always been there. There must have existed at some time, and at some place or other, an artificer or artificers who formed the watch for the purpose which we find it actually to answer. Who comprehended its construction and designed its use? Every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design which existed in the watch, exists in the works of nature, with the difference, on the side of nature, of being greater or more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation. The argument is intuitively very powerful, and likely to be brought up by most believers as a first response to the question of why they believe. It is also, predictably, the argument against which atheists have often concentrated most of their firepower. It is not my intention to convince the reader one way or the other, as this book isn't about apologetics, and even less so about atheism. I would be intellectually dishonest, however, if I did not put forth my own opinion, just as I did during my friendly chat with Epictetus. This is what good philosophers, and reasonable people in general, are supposed to do. Listen to each other's arguments, learn and reflect, and go out for a beer to talk it over some more. My considered opinion is that Epictetus's argument, and Aquinas's and Paley's, was eminently reasonable until sometime between the 18th and 19th centuries. What happened then was that two brilliant minds, one a philosopher, the other a scientist, dealt a powerful double punch to the argument from design. Those punches did not deliver a win by knockout. That rarely happens in philosophy. But I think the argument, though still vigorously defended by a number of theologians, philosophers, and even some scientists, has lost a significant amount of its appeal. The first cogent attack on the argument from design came from David Hume, who wrote, "If we see a house, we conclude with the greatest certainty that it had an architect or builder, because that is precisely that species of effect which we have experienced to proceed from that species of cause." But surely you will not affirm that the universe bears such a resemblance to a house that we can with the same certainty infer a similar cause, or that the analogy is here entire and perfect. Hume's point is subtle but crucial. He is basically saying that arguments from analogies, of which the one from design is an example, are notoriously problematic because analogies are always imperfect, and in some cases, downright misleading. More precisely, Hume acknowledges that if we see a manufactured object, we are justified in inferring the existence of a human maker, but only because we have actually seen or have otherwise incontrovertible evidence of people making things. In the case of the universe, however, we have never seen one being created, nor do we have any knowledge of the existence of a creator to begin with. Indeed, that is precisely the point under contention. How did the cosmos come about? Moreover, if a creator does exist, we have no idea of its attributes. Accordingly, Hume continued with a bit of mischievousness, which was dangerous at the time when he was writing. If we take the analogy between human and cosmic designers seriously, he argued, then we have to conclude that the latter have the following properties. There are many of them, they are fallible, and they are mortal. All suggestions that do not go at all well with a standard Christian theological account of God. Although Hume developed a powerful counter-argument against the appeal to design, one that is still studied in introductory philosophy courses today, he was missing something rather big, an alternative explanation for the undeniable appearance or design in the world, particularly the biological world. That missing piece was provided less than a century later by the great biologist Charles Darwin. His theory of evolution by natural selection is even now accepted as the scientific explanation of why eyes and hands and hearts and lungs do look like watches and swords, and yet are the product of natural phenomena that do not, in fact, require intelligent design. Moreover, Darwin combined his explanation of the appearance of design with the unanswered question of the existence of suffering in the world, another much-debated topic. As he explained in a famous letter, "But I own that I cannot see as plainly as others do, and I should wish to do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seems to me too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice. Not believing this, I see no necessity in the belief that the eye was expressly designed." Of course, Epictetus had not read Hume or Darwin, so I pointed out especially the last passage to him, and he responded in quintessential Stoic fashion, remembering that one day one of his students who had a wounded leg had complained about his injury, saying, "Am I then to have a maimed leg?" He told me that his response had been, shall we say, rather matter-of-fact, "Slave, do you mean to arraign the universe for one wretched leg?" Epictetus also often called me slave or boy, which, though somewhat politically incorrect, I find both endearing and fundamentally unobjectionable. He himself was a slave, and I am indeed significantly younger than him. Since this is an important aspect of Stoic metaphysics, it is worth examining a bit more carefully. Although Epictetus was arguably the most religious Stoic on record, he certainly didn't think that God should concern himself with every minutia pertaining to human affairs, much less with ichneumonid insects had he known about them, as is clear from his quip about the audaciousness of someone pretending that the whole universe should be rearranged so that his leg will not hurt. More importantly, many of the Stoics did not believe in anything like the modern monotheistic conception of God. Their preferred word for it was logos, which can be interpreted as the word of God, as the Christians who inherited a lot of Stoic philosophy did, or as a kind of providence embedded in the very fabric of the universe, or even more simply, as the rather straightforward observation that the cosmos can be understood rationally, regardless of how it came to be. Epictetus himself very clearly told his students that he did not think God was something external, something out there. "You are a principal work, a fragment of God himself. You have in yourself a part of him. You bear God about with you, poor wretch, and know it not. Do you think I speak of some external God of silver or gold?" In this sense, the Stoics can be thought of as pantheistic, or perhaps panentheistic, that is, as believing that God is the universe itself, and therefore we all partake in the divine nature. The only difference between human beings and other animals is that we are capable of the highest attribute of God or the universe, reason. That is why the proper way to live our lives is by using reason to tackle our problems. This identification of God with nature has a long history, and it was developed particularly by the influential 17th century Dutch philosopher Baruch Spinoza. It is sometimes referred to as Einstein's God, because a similar sentiment was expressed by the famous physicist. There are two related points to be noted about this conception of God. First, the divinity doesn't engage in miracles. This God does not suspend the laws of nature in order to intervene here and there to right local wrongs. Second, and relatedly, there is very little practical difference between this God and a simple acknowledgement made by the Stoics that the universe works through a web of cause and effect. This very modern concept is entirely compatible with the scientific view of the world as we understand it. Thus, we can similarly interpret Epictetus's somewhat flippant answer to the student with the maimed leg in two ways, either to mean that God concerns himself with the workings of the universe as a whole, not of every specific part, and it is therefore presumptuous to complain about one's own issues, or to mean that the wound resulted from a series of causes and effects that certainly did not have the student's well-being in mind when they occurred. So it is futile to remonstrate against the outcome. Either way, to ask for things to be otherwise would indeed be to pretend to arraign the universe for the sake of one wretched leg. Moreover, such a petition would of course be a flagrant violation of the principle of the dichotomy of control, which we have seen is fundamental to Epictetus's teachings. Epictetus replied to me that he was aware of the different opinions concerning the gods, but insisted that he could make sense of only one of them. Concerning the gods, there are some who say that the divine does not exist, others that it exists, but is inactive and indifferent and takes no thought for anything. Others again that God does exist and take thought, but only for great things and things in the heavens, but for nothing on earth. And a fourth class say that God takes thought also for earthly and human things, but only in a general way, and has no care for individuals. And there is a fifth class, to whom belong Odysseus and Socrates, who say, "Wherever I move, thou seest me. For if there are no gods, how can following the gods be the end of man? If, again, there are gods, but they care for nothing, in that case too, what good will it be to follow them?" As much as I admire the prose, here I reminded him that Stoicism does not actually maintain that the end of man is to follow the gods. That was his own version. What the Stoics, including Epictetus, said, as we have seen, is that we should live our lives while following nature, and it is reasonable to equate this with following the gods only once we have clarified the relationship between nature and the gods, which Epictetus never really did. In fact, there was disagreement on this point both among Stoics and between them and rival schools, such as the Epicureans. The followers of Epicurus are often portrayed as atheists, but they were nothing of the kind. They were what we today would call deists, falling into the third group enumerated by Epictetus. According to them, God does exist, but he is immersed in the contemplation of divine things, paying no heed at all to earthly matters and human affairs. The world, for the Epicureans, is made of a chaos of atoms randomly bumping into each other, and while human beings are capable of using reason, their decisions and actions are still held hostage, not to a divine providence, but to the effects of physical force. Some Stoics conceded this possibility, and others went so far as to appropriate some of Epicurus's thoughts and maintain, correctly, that philosophy isn't religion, it has no sacred texts, and it does not follow unquestionable doctrines. On the contrary, as Seneca aptly put it, "That which is true is mine," meaning that a reasonable person makes truth her own, regardless of whether it comes from friends or foes. One of the Stoics who agreed with Epictetus's general take on the divine, but was more open-minded than him on such matters, was none other than the emperor philosopher Marcus Aurelius. It seems clear that Marcus believed in gods. On the one hand, It is possible to rationalize some of his generic references to them as not necessarily reflecting faith, but rather a broad form of piety, as, for instance, when he wrote, "To the gods I am indebted for having good grandfathers, good parents, a good sister, good teachers, good associates, good kinsmen and friends, nearly everything good." On the other hand, however, he was pretty explicit in other places. "Since it is possible that you might depart from life this very moment, regulate every act and thought accordingly. But to go away from among men, if there are gods, is not a thing to be afraid of, for the gods will not involve you in evil. But if indeed they do not exist, or if they have no concern about human affairs, why would I wish to live in a universe devoid of gods or devoid of providence? But in truth, they do exist, and they do care for human things, and they have put all the means in man's power to enable him not to fall into real evils." Then again, Marcus very explicitly says a surprisingly high number of times in the Meditations that it doesn't matter whether the universe is governed by a providential divinity, in whatever form, or by random chaos, as the Epicureans thought, thus showing himself to be less certain in some questions of metaphysics than Epictetus. Here is a taste of what I mean. "You have embarked, made the voyage, and come to shore. Get out. If indeed to another life, there is no want of gods. Not even there. But if to a state without sensation, you will cease to be held by pains and pleasures. Or consider this. Either there is a fatal necessity and invincible order, or a kind providence, or a confusion without a purpose and without a director. If then there is an invincible necessity, why do you resist? But if there is a providence that allows itself to be propitiated, make yourself worthy of the help of the divinity. But if there is a confusion without a governor, be content that in such a tempest you have yourself a certain ruling intelligence." It hardly gets more ecumenical than this. Considering our discussion so far, you may have been wondering why, given Epictetus's insistent talk about God contrasting so sharply with my own skepticism, I have chosen him as a companion for this voyage of exploration of Stoicism. Indeed, you might reasonably ask why someone who is non-religious is interested in Stoicism at all, given what can charitably be described as the ambiguity of Stoics toward the divine. The answer goes to the heart of what I think makes Stoicism such an attractive philosophy for the 21st century. I used to be a brash atheist, even before New Atheism was a thing. When I was living in Tennessee, secure in my conviction that creationists were little more than country bumpkins waiting to be enlightened by the worldly professor from Rome, I debated scores of people who believed the earth to be only a few thousand years old. But I was seriously mistaken. Not about the age of the earth. On that count, I'm pretty confident of my science trumping their religious doctrine, but rather on the point of the whole exercise. The first time this struck me was after a debate with Duane Gish, then the vice president of the Institute for Creation Research, which, to be clear, does no such thing. I remember feeling quite smug after having scored, or so I thought, a couple of really good rhetorical blows against Gish that evening. But after the debate, I was approached by a number of people from his side who behaved very politely toward me and said, "You know, I still don't believe you are right and the Bible is wrong, but I appreciated tonight that you were nice and correct while debating Dr. Gish." I hadn't made an impression on these folks by way of my astute science-based arguments, but simply by showing up and behaving like a decent human being rather than the prick they expected. That point has been reiterated for me countless times now over the course of several encounters with a number of believers, both Christians and those of other persuasions. Moreover, I have learned that most of the time there is precious little difference between my actual conduct and their own in the business of everyday life. And if we are talking about mainstream religionists, as opposed to fundamentalists, our opinions on most crucial matters of ethics and politics are rarely that different, despite the fact that mine are allegedly informed by my atheism and theirs by their faith. To put it in philosophical terms, it appears that much of our diverging metaphysics makes little difference to what we think is important in life, or to how we behave toward others. If that is the case, why would I want to walk away from my believing interlocutors and join the new atheists over at their tent, where they are as exclusive in whom they welcome as various groups of religious fundamentalists are about whom they admit to church. And what does this have to do with Stoicism? One of the things that attracted me to it from the get-go is precisely what others may consider one of its weaknesses. Given the Stoic ambiguity over how to interpret the Logos, Stoics can build a very large tent indeed, welcoming everyone from atheists to agnostics, from pantheists and panentheists to theists, as long as none of these guests impose their own metaphysical views on the others. Are you a Christian or Muslim or practicing Jew? Fine, you can treat the Logos as a central attribute of a personal God who created the universe. Does your metaphysical preference lean more toward the idea that God is everywhere, to be identified with nature itself? Then you will feel at home with many of the original Stoics and their conception of the rational principle of the universe. Are you instead an agnostic or atheist? If so, the Logos represents the indisputable fact that the cosmos really is organized rationally, even though we still do not know how such organization came about, whether by design or as a result of brute cause and effect. If this were not the case, then logic, mathematics, and science itself would go out the window, and you do believe in them, right? Mind you, this is no counsel for laziness of mind, or for a politically correct and bland mix of otherwise incompatible positions. It is simply the realization that what is important in life is to live it well, and that such an objective, the eudaimonic existence sought by the ancients, depends very little on whether there is a God or not, and if there is one, on what its specific attributes may or may not be. Besides, as Cicero wisely put it, there are many questions in philosophy to which no satisfactory answer has yet been given, but the question of the nature of the gods is the darkest and most difficult of all. So various and so contradictory are the opinions of the most learned men on this matter as to persuade one of the truth of the saying that philosophy is the child of ignorance. This was true 2 millennia ago, and despite what you may have heard of late, it is still true today. So why don't we agree to disagree on this particular matter and get on together with the serious business of living a good life?